Well, hello, and welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast. Join me, Sam Harris, on my journey of curiosity and growth. I have conversations with some of the world's most fascinating humans, from billionaires to Olympians, and most everyone in between, such as suspiciously happy people and even a hitman. Success isn't just for successful people, it is earned and you can earn it too. I find out how ordinary people become extraordinary to fuel your own growth mindset.
Thanks a lot for coming on and welcome to the show. And can you introduce yourself in 3 minutes, basically just give a summary of your life up to now?
Absolutely. Well, Sam, thank you for having me on the show. I really appreciate it. My name is Jason Mueller. I'm the founder of Little Inner Voice. We do a podcast and training for folks who are looking to take their passion projects, their thing, and turn it into a real business. That's what I do right now. My life story, I don't talk about it often, but it's an important piece of kind of understanding who I am and how I got to where I am at. I have Tourette syndrome, which is a disease that causes involuntary muscle movements. And most folks know about Tourette syndrome because they know it as the swearing disease. That's kind of the way it's portrayed in popular culture. And that's a specific kind of tic. It's called coprolalia. I didn't have that, fortunately, growing up. Mine were motor tics. And so growing up, every year at the beginning of a school year, because you're a kid that's twitching uncontrollably in the classroom, that's going to draw some attention, I would do a little speech in front of my class, starting in second grade and going up to middle school. I would talk about what Tourette syndrome was, how it affected me, how it wouldn't affect them. And it did a couple of things. It got me used to public speaking. It got me interested in how people react to things, because obviously you want to understand why this kid is being mean to you and why that kid's not, and why the teacher over here is suddenly way more understanding and forgiving about things. And so that was kind of a big part of my youth growing up. Fast forward to middle school. I was a bit of a drama geek. My voice had changed, had gotten deeper. And I had a teacher step in and say, you know what? You should do something with that. You should take these things that you love, the acting, your voice, being able to be in front of people, and use that to your advantage. So I decided to explore what kind of options were out there. One of the things that really drew me in was radio. And while I had been accepted to the University of Minnesota, Minnesota also has a small broadcasting school that is pretty popular. And I decided, let's give it a shot. Worst thing that happens is I waste a year and I go to the U next year. And I went there and I loved it. These were my people. They were class clowns. They were performers. They were sarcastic. They were just fun to be around. And so I went through school there, got into broadcasting myself, became a DJ, became a newsman. I worked my way up to a news director, had a ton of cool experiences there. I got to interview governors and senators, cover murder trials. I got to ride on an Army Black Hawk helicopter one time. And my wife said, you know what, Jason, I'd like to have a family. And I was making a pittance in radio. So we decided to move back to our Twin Cities home base where my family was and where her families were, and started a life there. I got a regular job at a company, worked my way up to middle management. And then when I was 30 years old, suddenly got a serious infection that almost killed me. And it was pretty dramatic. You don't go through something like that. I've got a couple of kids, a wife, a new family, my budding career. And in a heartbeat, everything changes. And so it really made me evaluate what I want in life. Why am I doing the things that I'm doing? And I started taking all those things that had kind of been here and there passions, things that were interesting, but maybe not my major focus, and started making them my major focus. I got very into personal development, understanding psychology, understanding kind of how things work. And over the last few years, I've just been building that out and working with other people who have found themselves in similar situations who want tools and techniques to get them past it.
Cool. Well, thanks for that summary. It's interesting. I've got a lot of similarities, I think, in some of the things that you've been doing. Okay, well, I haven't spent a career living, working in radio and then had a wife and kids, but I'm more interested to actually try and find if I can do a one day a week kind of working at a radio show or something at the moment to get some more experience in that. So I think it'd be really fun. But you have a great radio voice, I must say.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
I'm very jealous. Been working on it. You should have seen me 3 years ago when I first started the podcast. Didn't speak any single syllable clearly. It's a nightmare. So at the start, I guess the Tourette's, I hadn't really noticed at all that you had Tourette's or anything. So would you say that's been like quite difficult to live with, or how has it affected you?
Yeah. So early on, for a lot of people with Tourette syndromes, after they go through puberty, it kind of wanes off. It just goes away. And there's still little tics here and there, but it's not nearly as bad. The height for many people is right around puberty. So as I was growing up from about kindergarten through, I'd say, eighth or ninth grade, it was pretty rough. I mean, I was twitching quite a bit. My ninth grade, I didn't even take my finals that year because I couldn't hold a pencil. My arms were moving so much. But at that point, I was already in a lot of high performance classes. They weren't concerned that I didn't know the material. And so they just waived it for me. So that was a struggle, certainly growing up. But, you know, as an adult, my tics are so minor that if I hadn't told you that, you'd probably never notice that I have anything.
No. Yeah. That's good to hear. Yeah. So you said you did the public speaking, which is pretty bold for a child. So did you find it hard to explain to people, which is why you had to do the public part? Or was it just sort of, I don't know, did you feel kind of like isolated from the rest of the kids?
Yeah. When you're out on the playground and you're twitching and nobody really understands why, you know, there are kids, it's just, you're different at that point. And obviously kids like to go after things that are different. So it's, in a lot of ways, it's no different than anybody else who struggled with something growing up. And that was my way of heading it off. My parents were very firm on being a self-advocate, on understanding what's going on and making sure other people understand as well, because then nobody's coming at you out of ignorance, right? If they're just going to be a jerk, you can't help that.
What was like the most useful thing that you said in your speech that helped people, do you think?
I think I just put it out there, because most kids just want to be good people. They want to just have fun and do their own thing. And they're so wrapped up in their own drama, they don't really care about yours. So putting it out in the open, it wasn't a secret. It wasn't something they had to whisper and you know, snicker about the background. And then the teacher was aware of it too. So there was no excuse for it. And if someone was teasing me about it, the teacher would almost instantly shut it down.
That's nice. I imagine that before we started that I broke my leg recently. It was quite insightful just being stuck in a wheelchair for a while, just to sort of, because you know that people are in a wheelchair and they can't do certain things, but just being in it myself, you notice sort of the tiniest gradient just like throws you off, or you can't even go in a straight line, and like all these different ways of viewing the world that you just don't have if you haven't ever actually ever been there. So it's just kind of like, what are the kind of things that most people didn't even notice that you maybe couldn't do? Because obviously, sure, you can't go and play cricket or like football or something, I guess, but like what were the things that sort of maybe people wouldn't realize?
That's a great question. You know, it changes your frame of reference. I think that's kind of what you're getting at. In some cases, people didn't know how to deal with it. And so when, by putting it out there, it was like I was giving them permission to ask me questions and to not treat it as like some weird thing that's happening and that we're all just going to pretend doesn't happen. I imagine in a wheelchair, some of your friends probably were very casual about it, but maybe other people weren't sure. Should I get the door for him? Should I help him with this? Is that too much? Yeah. So I had a very similar experience. When I was having really bad tics and I couldn't do something, people weren't sure. Should I step in? Should I not? Would he get angry if I asked that question? And so by putting it out there, it just became like a normal part of conversation in a way that was okay for people to broach.
Yeah. Have you read the book, The Elephant in the Room?
I haven't.
Oh, yeah. You really like it. It's really good. It's about things that go in your brain that you maybe aren't aware of, but also things sort of hidden knowledge versus common knowledge. So like everyone knows that you have a tic, but they don't know if they can talk about it until like you've talked about it kind of thing. It's the same sort of stuff that kind of goes on at like a lower level, even though everyone knows, but you have to sort of make it acceptable and things then. So it just makes it much easier. Yeah, it's a really good book.
I will definitely check that out. Thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure. Cool. Okay. That was quite interesting. And then you kind of just got mostly better pretty much afterwards. But I guess you sort of had a bit of a different childhood experience compared to most people then from that, which is quite fascinating. And then, so you said you kind of had the passion for speaking when you were in the direction of broadcast and things. So what was the biggest driver that took you in that direction? Was it because you wanted to like share your voice and have people listening to you? Was it because you kind of just liked working with like technology and things? Like what was the thing that pushed you there?
So it was a little bit of all of those things. I had an English teacher in high school who was also one of the directors. We did three plays a year at my school and she was the director of one of them. And she really kind of took me under her wing. She saw that I had this talent and that I had this passion, and she really mentored me on how to bring it out, how to make the most of it, and really encouraged me to go explore other things. She encouraged me to write to broadcasters who are already in the field and ask them what they did to get there. She encouraged me to explore acting and other things. And so it was really just that push in that direction. And then finally experiencing it for myself, where it just, I don't know if you've ever had one of those experiences where you walk into a group of people and you're like, this is it. This is me. This is where I belong.
Definitely. That's cool. Yeah, I definitely relate to that. Like, I was studying civil engineering for like a month, which I just wasn't really enjoying at uni. And I kind of just walked into a biology lecture. And I don't know, just the lecturer was just really nice and everyone was really cool. And like, we were just doing cool stuff. I was like, this is my place. It's definitely that sort of feeling. So then you kind of had like a career for 10 years in radio.
Yeah, I started when I was 18 and I went into kind of, I think I was 27 when we finally stopped. And I've been doing voiceover work ever since on freelance basis and other things. But the radio itself was between 8 and 10 years.
Cool. So did you have like a regular radio spot exactly, or like a full-time thing?
Yeah, I was full-time. So my first radio station that I worked at, I was a disc jockey. It was an AM country station in rural Minnesota. It was about as far out as you can get. Yeah. I would look out the studio window and there were literally sheep grazing in the field right next to the building. That's how far out in the middle of nowhere we were. And, you know, I'm an 18-year-old kid. I don't know the first thing about country music, and let alone rural living. So it was a little bit of culture shock, but it was a ton of fun to get to become kind of a minor celebrity in this community and go out and meet people and do that full time. So I would be on the air for 5 hours. I'd do production for 3 hours. And then I would come in Sundays for a couple of hours and do work there. And then when I moved into news, you know, there aren't really hours for news. You're basically living at the radio station because it's such a small staff.
Cool. So what would you say would be your advice to someone who hasn't done radio or a degree but wants to get into it then?
Well, I have two pieces of advice. My first would be don't. It was easily the most fun job I've ever had, but it was the lowest paying job I've ever had as well. When you get an industry where there are a lot of people who want to do something, the wages generally don't come up. And in radio, there's kind of a hierarchy of markets. And so you start small and then you advance quickly to other markets as you prove that you're good at what you do. So, you know, we're used to listening to the big personalities on national broadcasts and things like that. Those guys have been working years to get there. You're going to start out in the middle of nowhere, you know, with sheep outside the window, talking to people about songs you probably never heard before. And so you've got to love it. You've got to work hard at it, and you've got to move quickly. You can't get into radio and be content to just stay where you are.
Okay. So as in like try and make opportunities and constantly sort of be applying for new shows and things. What does that mean?
Yeah, it means moving forward, right? If you're just going to stay where you're at, there will be a lot of opportunities to do that. Meaning you could go to a market, be a big fish in a little pond. And if that's what you're cool with, you're fine. If you want to be one of those big guys with the big contracts, making lots of money in a big market, you're going to have a lot of stops from here to there. And so you just have to get aggressive about applying for new positions, knowing what's going on in the trends in the industry, and making sure you're pushing forward.
So if you've run businesses or you've kind of climbed mountains and these kind of things, is it easier to become a radio show host and sort of be like the guy that's sort of the person that knows about this or something?
That's interesting. I'd say it's a trade-off either way. I basically lived at the radio station for those years that I worked in radio, because you've got a tight-knit group of people. There's probably only a handful of other jocks who are working there, maybe a news guy or two. So it becomes very tight. And so as a DJ, you're doing remotes, you're doing all this other stuff. Like I wouldn't have had time for that and a family at this point in my career, especially given what I was being paid at the time. But the flip side is I'm more mature. I can have a better conversation. I have more background. I would feel much more comfortable as a talk show host today than I did at, 22, because I can just have a more intelligent conversation with you or with anybody than I could back then.
Yeah, that's interesting. Cool. So you did that, the news thing, but you didn't do any like specific kind of, what am I trying to say? Like, I have Radio 4, but like sort of where you tell like a proper story where it's from like a half an hour of like, okay, we're going to have like a talk about sort of sexual health or something every sort of week or something, that kind of thing. Did you have anything like that?
So I did have a talk show, and it was very political driven. I used to be kind of a news and political junkie in my youth. I've outgrown that, thankfully. It was much more individual newscasts that we'd run throughout the day on the different stations. And then for an hour a day, I'd hop on in between two other talk shows and talk about local issues that were going on that were important to folks. Cool.
Do you think there is a way to kind of make more money out of it without just being like one of the celebrity peoples? And is it more like podcasting? Is that why you've gone into that now?
I would say I would highly recommend, if you're interested in this kind of work, to make it your own. I think, Sam, you probably experienced this with your own career and with people you've interviewed. Being an entrepreneur and being the guy in charge, having the ability to make those decisions, to decide what we're going to do, what we're not going to do, how we're going to monetize it, is always going to lead to more opportunities than having to follow the script of somebody else. Mm-hmm. So it really is the difference between being an entrepreneur and being an employee. And the path to stardom on podcasting is similar in that you kind of have to pay your dues, but you can also find different strategies to get your name out there, to get your show out there, and to get new opportunities that you wouldn't as a DJ or a news person in radio.
Cool. So what do you think, besides reaching out to other podcasts and just getting good people on your podcast, what other ways would you say would be the best way to like get publicity then?
Well, there are a couple of different ways. You can buy an audience, right? You can go out there with paid traffic. That's certainly something I've experimented with and that I've seen a lot of other people use successfully. You can borrow somebody else's audience. There are partnerships that you can strike with people. I've certainly tried that in the past. It's something that I'd like to do more of. You know, one of the things you can do, especially if you have a podcast, is you can say, hey, Sam, do you have me on your podcast? I'd love to have you on mine. And then we can chat about different things in different ways. And you kind of cross-pollinate with the different audiences. So there's lots of different ways. You can use emails. You can go out there and actually buy a list of people who are interested in a specific topic. You can pay someone who already has a list and get an opportunity to speak to those folks. So there's different strategies you can use depending on your resources and your boldness.
Yeah, I guess it's always things to do when you think they aren't, which is a good growth mindset one. So people kind of feel like, oh, I'm not famous, I can't do anything, there's no way I can get an audience. And you're like, actually, there's lots of ways. You just have to kind of knock on doors and do things.
And it's amazing what just simple SEO can do. I mean, you've got great show notes on your shows. You do a nice job with your description so that when somebody is searching for things, they know if they want to talk about mindset, if they want to talk about growth, they want to talk about AI or science or technology, you're probably going to pop up in that search somewhere. I didn't have any audience with Little Inner Voice when I first started. Putting my show out there, getting people that I know and people that care about my success to review it and push me up in the ratings, I was suddenly visible to people who never even heard of me, but started to explore that. So especially early on, there's a window of opportunity where you can really push yourself into places that you might not get to go 6 months down the line.
Interesting, kind of went into mindsets and things from your life and stuff. But then you wanted to make more money and change career. So what was the job you then went into?
I was just looking for a job. I originally started doing sales. I had a buddy who was actually a part-time DJ at the radio station, but a full-time sales guy. And he told me about an opportunity with a company that sold, this is the lamest thing ever, they sold planners to schools. And it was based on the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People curriculum. They would sell planners that talked about productivity, begin with the end in mind, all the 7 habits stuff, right? Mm. But aimed at middle school and high school kids. And so I tried that. I'd never done anything in sales before. And I learned a lot. It was the first job I've ever had that, frankly, I wasn't very good at. I mean, I'm a smart guy. I've had a lot of success in my career. I've found that most jobs I do, I'm very good at. This was one I was just terrible at.
It's humbling though, and sounds like you're still learning stuff from it, which is, I guess, what everything's about. Yeah, interesting. So like, what do you think, you were naturally not that good at sales, but did you get good at it eventually, or did you change after that?
I had a lot of things working against me. One, I didn't have the confidence to be able to do it well at that point in my life and in my career. And the guy who had been in that territory for 15 years, had just moved to a competitor. So he had already established a lot of those relationships. And so a lot of the clients came with him. And so I decided after a year, this wasn't working out. My boss agreed. I was laid off. They actually eliminated the territory as an outside sales position. And so there I was with two newborn infants, my wife, who was, you know, literally a month out of the hospital and no job. And so I was scrambling to find something. And I found a company that was looking for a voiceover person full time in the Twin Cities. And I just figured, what the heck? Give it a try. They wanted part time again, low pay. But I wanted to see if it was a fit and if it could maybe just bridge the gap until I found a better job. And it turns out it was a small company that needed people who knew a lot about this stuff, knew about production and knew about organization and building things and process and all of these things that I just naturally know pretty well. And so I worked my way up in that company and I was there for 13 or 14 years. I worked my way up from part-time vocal guy to the director of operations, running multiple departments and managing, you know, million-dollar projects.
Cool. Nice. What do you think? What was the reason for your success on that? And just sort of your attitude of turning up and trying to take on more things and was in your remit, or I'll let you.
When I first began there doing the part-time work, I was feeling pretty down, right? I mean, I felt like I was in a bad position with my family because I was supposed to be the person who was supporting them and I couldn't. I'd just come off a job that I didn't do a very good job at for a year. And so it was one of those things where I was kind of wallowing in self-pity for a bit. I did work my way up to the manager of that department, but I probably would have stayed there for a good chunk of my career if I hadn't had that illness. I got an infection in my neck when I was 30 years old that, like I said, almost killed me. I had to take several weeks off of work. And when you go through something like that, you're automatically evaluating every decision you've made. What do I want? Because your sense of mortality is suddenly very urgent. That immortality that you have in your 20s ripped away from me. And so I said, I don't want to do this for the rest of my life. I want to do something more. I want to contribute to the world. I want to contribute to help other people. And I can't do that here. And I'm completely frustrated. I'm not happy. And the rationale that I used was, okay, well, I'll just be happy someday. You know, I'll be 60, I'll retire, and then I can be happy. Now 60 wasn't a guarantee. You know, I might get another infection and might not make it. So I went into my boss's office and I said, this is what I want. And it wasn't an ultimatum. It was, I want to do more. I can take on more. And I started talking through some of the things that I felt like we could be doing better as a company. And he agreed. And I started advancing from there until I made it to the director position. But I think there's something to be said for that kind of self-advocacy, knowing what you want and not being afraid to go get it. I mean, the worst thing that would have happened is my boss would have said, Jason, no. I mean, nice job. Pat me on the head condescendingly and send me on my way. But I think most people, especially if you're good at what you do, you're competent, you care, you're passionate, they're going to listen if you have suggestions, if you have different ways of doing things that may lead to better outcomes for everyone.
Yeah, it quite relates to, well, my TED speech is going to be about, I'm doing one in March, which is sort of understanding yourself better and like understanding what you really want and just having more confidence to go and do it and like breaking like the rules that you think are rules, like things that you can and can't do, and actually not really necessarily breaking rules, but just sort of realizing that they don't even exist and they're just in your mind or things, and basically unlock the potential that's there. But said much smarter, hopefully, for 15 minutes. But it's going to be good. It's a useful example there. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's what you're describing is a lot of the things that we talk about in Little Inner Voice.
Yeah, perfectly leads to now talk more into what you're doing. So I think I was about to introduce what you're about to say anyway.
All right, the Little Inner Voice, Sam, it's all just an analogy, right? It's a metaphor to explain all these different concepts. Most people don't care about the why. They just want to know, like, what's actually happening and how do I use it to my advantage? How do I make it work for me? So we kind of break down those concepts into three aspects of your little inner voice. You've got the ally, the bureaucrat, and the critic. Your little inner ally, that's your confidence, it's your drive, it's your ambition. Your little inner bureaucrat, it's the thing you were just describing. It's the rules of your life that we've kind of accumulated. And do they work for you? Do they work against you? What's right? What's wrong? What should and shouldn't happen? And then the little inner critic, it's the back of your head always saying, you can't do this. This is stupid. Why are you even thinking about this? You know, it's the self-doubt. It's the lack of confidence and how all of those play out. I think most people deal with their little inner critic and their little inner bureaucrat in negative ways. It's stopping them from doing the kinds of things they want to do. And it's the point of conflict for a lot of their lives. I think it's exactly what you're describing there.
Yeah, definitely. It's kind of annoying because it's kind of like the elephant in your brain. You often don't see the things that are in your brain and what it's doing. And trying to get people to kind of almost as in the, if like you could see in infrared, you could see different things, like being able to see like the things in their brain that they don't realize are there. And it's like you can give examples of yourself, but it's obviously it's not the same for other people. So trying to get them to see them is like the skill in that, which is what I'm trying to break down in the kind of TED talk and things. But that's a really nice way of like talking about it.
Well, how have you broken that down? I'd be interested in hearing that.
You hear lots of TED speeches which kind of go into these things, and like you sort of sit there and you're like, yeah, yeah, I get it. But then like it doesn't change your life too much afterwards. And it's trying to sort of show people that you can do like really outrageous things. So I'm kind of making, I'm talking about feminism at one point. There's this good feminist quote that's like, why do people say grow some balls? Like they're quite weak and sensitive. They should say grow a vagina. They can take a real pounding. And you're like, yeah, actually, it's the complete opposite. We've got the complete, you should be saying grow a vagina the whole time when you say go and be manly and like do hard shit. And I also talk about like just sort of addiction and like phones and how like they kind of like control your brain too much. And so just breaking out of addiction cycles and trying to just addict yourself to doing things that are useful for you and just like changing rules. And so like at the end of my TED speech, like I also talk about like the importance of time and you know, it's very finite and like just sort of living a life, because the only person that watches your entire life is you. So you may as well make it as entertaining for you as possible kind of thing, because like no one else cares that much. You may as well enjoy it for yourself. And then like the final summary is like, okay, stop playing with your phone, just grow a big vagina and learn to play with yourself, which is like, you can't tell the TED audience to play with their vaginas. Like this is 2020 and I'm a white guy, but I just did that. And I did something that was impossible and was like a barrier to what you're allowed to say in a TED speech. But actually like I used that barrier and I just stood on top of it. And I actually made my point more powerful and memorable by using the thing that was a limitation. So instead of having a limit, I have leverage. It's not like a problem. It's like it was potential instead. So it's like seeing like, holy shit, all these things that you think are just barriers, like are actually really useful if you sort of work with them and understand them. And it doesn't like give people the exact example for them, but it's just something that's really out there and different. And all these things that I thought were real, it's like that kind of matrix, there is no spoon because you just done something you can't do, but it actually it was better kind of thing. So yeah, that's the basic shortest summary I can do, which is still understandable, I guess.
I love it. I want to hear that when you do it. I want to copy.
Yeah, sure. Like it's going to be March 14th or something, so I need to like write it up properly. But I am getting quite excited. So trying to work on these things. Just sort of trying to like do something you really can't do just to show people that you can do things that you can't do in like a meta principle. It's like the best way I figured I could get there.
And you're living it, clearly.
Yeah, trying. Thanks. Anyway, mild tangent. So how long have you been running the Little Inner Voice?
I've been doing this for a couple of years. And, you know, it's been something that is, I wouldn't say on and off, but it's been different intensities over those couple of years. I've been trying to understand a lot of the psychology, a lot of the biology behind some of these things that are going on so that I could ground it in something meaningful. And so that's taken time. And then just at my own personal growth, I'm totally comfortable in a situation like this, in an audience of 10,000 in front of me. But one-on-one, especially in a sales situation, has been a lot more challenging for me. So turning it from something that's fun and interesting and a passion project into a real business has been a growth experience for me. It's been something that's taken probably most of those last 3 years to get to a point now where I'm ready to grow. I'm ready to show a lot of other people what we're doing and hopefully help them in a meaningful way as well.
Cool. Okay. So what's the main things that you do? You kind of just, because you work one-on-one with people, can you sort of understand what their problem is to sort of give them their specific example? Or do you have like more general principles of ways to teach this to people?
So I like to start with those general principles and work kind of towards the specifics. In a lot of studying, a lot of personal experience, a lot of talking this through with other people, a lot of research, taking those skills that I built as a reporter and kind of synthesizing some of this stuff down, what I think is going on for a lot of people is we've all got this narrative that we tell ourselves. It's the story you were describing, right? And I think most people have stories about themselves, about what's going on in the world, about how they experience things, and that informs their beliefs. And from there, their beliefs inform their perception of the world. There's so much going on. You can take it all in, but you don't notice it all. And the example I give is when you buy a new car, you probably didn't notice those cars on the road before. But after you bought one, they're everywhere, right? Now, nothing's changed. There aren't more of those cars on the road except for the one more you bought. But you're suddenly noticing them because they're important to you. They're in front of you. And so we have this cycle of story, belief, perception that kind of reinforces itself. And that plays into how a lot of people live. Let me give you an example. If someone said, Sam, I need a 2-paragraph description of you. Who are you? What would you say?
I would say I am an entrepreneur, podcast host, explorer who kind of can't keep a job and just does lots of random stuff and should probably be a bit more reliable, but I like having fun. It depends on where this is being put, I guess.
Like, and that's a good point too, right? I mean, the context matters. This is the story you tell people who you want the public face of, but you probably also have a story about yourself inside. You know, are you a lucky person? Are you a smart person? All these attributes that are just self-assigned in a lot of ways. And we tell that story about ourselves, which when they get confirmed, suddenly become a belief. They're the foundation of what you think is going on. And once you've got that story and the belief, now that's what you're looking for. If you think, you know, you're a smart guy, you're a guy who's bouncing between different jobs, you're looking for those opportunities that are always out there. Whereas someone who thinks of themselves as a steady 9-to-5, I clock in, I clock out, they're not looking for those opportunities, even though they may exist everywhere. So if you can start to change that story that you're telling about yourself, that will gradually, as you confirm it, start to change your beliefs and start to change what you notice. And then that reinforcing circle works to your benefit. That's what we call a live cycle. It's taking your little inner voice to shape and mold that story in a way that works for you instead of potentially against you, which is where a lot of people struggle.
Very interesting. So I think it's definitely a dual nature between your sort of beliefs and your own mindset and then like the environment that you're in. So like you might believe that you're not very good at like eating less or something, but for me, I find that if I just don't have anything there to eat, like I don't really think about it too much, but like, if I'm working in the kitchen all day, I just won't stop eating kind of thing. And it doesn't really matter what my brain is or what my belief is about things. It's just easier to just like go somewhere that isn't the house and not take snacks with me kind of thing.
Because it's not front of mind, right? It's not there in your perception. Yeah. You're not thinking about it. You just move on with life.
It's quite interesting the way you think of yourself as lucky when you're kind of always out there and like talking to people and like stuff just kind of happens to be there at the right time. But if you're never doing those things, it just never happens. And yeah, it's kind of weird really, because it is just sort of what's in your environment and what you're like available for really.
Exactly. What you're paying attention to, what you're open to, it becomes self-reinforcing. Like if you think you're lucky, you're going to find those things, and then it's just going to confirm the fact that you think you're lucky.
How do you think, do you have to help people much with like other parts of their mind as well as success? Like, so just like anger and like these kind of things. Like, so I guess if you can't just deal with one part of the mind, it's like a whole thing.
Well, I think that framework that we talk about kind of works for a lot of different things. So we look at what results they're getting now in an area they want to focus on. So if it's something like anger, I'm frustrated with not getting the results I want. I want to be making $1 million this year and I'm not even making $10,000 right now. Or I can't get what I need over here, even though I deserve it. We look at what that story is that they're telling themselves right now. And we do that by just exploring kind of what's happening. And we can kind of work that cycle backwards to figure out what story they're actually telling themselves. What are you seeing in life? What are the results you're getting? What do those mean to you? What are you thinking about those kinds of things? And then working back from perception, belief to story. And once we can figure out roughly what the story is, we can start inserting a new one. And that's not something that happens instantly, but it's essentially an affirmation. You're telling yourself something new. And as you start to notice things that confirm what you think, gradually you start to believe it more. And once you start to believe it more, then you start to perceive the world with that set of beliefs through that filter. And it kind of goes on autopilot at that point.
It's definitely interesting. Maybe you can't describe exactly, but what was like the hardest sort of person that you had to turn around? And what was it that you kind of did this?
You know, the hardest client, and I'll be honest, I didn't get a success story out of it. I feel like too many people just sugarcoat their experiences and aren't honest about it. So I'm just as open about my failures as I am about my successes. When you have someone who really wants something new, they want to build a business for themselves. They've got something that they're very passionate about, but also are struggling with a lot of confidence and other issues that their little inner critic is just beating them up over all the time. There has to be a willingness to do something different. So I can teach you about business. I can teach you about promotion. I can teach you about copywriting and all the technical stuff, project management. I can give you all the skills in the world. But if you don't have the confidence to try something new, if you don't have the confidence to really put yourself out there in a new way, it's not going to work. I mean, that's the whole point, is you don't need another course on some skill. What you need is to manage your little inner voice, to take it from a big obstacle and turn it into a tool. And the woman I was working with, brilliant woman, high performing, had a great career, and she was very passionate about an illness that had run in her family. But she was also a very private person. And so that transition from someone who was private, but someone who almost had to become kind of a public figure, the face of what she was promoting, she couldn't make that transition. And it didn't matter what we did in terms of working on the story, in terms of working on her beliefs, she just wasn't ready to do that. And no amount of convincing or teaching could get her there. It's really a choice that somebody has to make. They have to be ready to do things in a different way, to really work on the story that they're telling themselves so that those beliefs can start to form naturally. If you don't believe something is true, you're never going to get there, right? I mean, a belief is either 100% true or not. There's no in between. And so she couldn't make that transition. And so unfortunately, we ended our relationship because there was nothing else I could do to get her over that hump. It was something she was going to have to decide. And that comes down to mindset as well, right? I mean, if your mindset is, this is who I am, these are the results I'm going to get, and there's just no changing it, until that mindset changes, that's where you're going to be. And there's nothing anyone around you can do to fix it. One of the things I think I found in both training and in my own experience is when you're working with a client, you can't give them solutions. You can help them identify the problem, but really the solutions have to come from them. Otherwise, they don't stick. What happens is if they implement it, your solution, and it doesn't work, then you're the problem and they resent you for it. Or they don't do it the way you imagine because maybe you missed some detail, or you've got a set of skills that you could implement it with that they don't. And I've always found walking them up to the problem is as far as you can go as a coach and get good results afterwards.
Is there like anything you can do in terms of giving them like a framework to like keep on seeing what it is that they're doing and look for the right things to get better? I don't know. Yeah, because then you must be able to help them in some ways, like facilitate it
besides absolutely
showing them like a mirror of themselves, I guess.
And that's the best use of a coach, right? Is to be the person who can, the old phrase is, you can't read the label on your own jar because you're inside, you can't see it, but somebody from the outside can see it more clearly. So you can help them spot things that they didn't notice. You can ask questions to make them think of things they hadn't been thinking of. I can give them the framework of little inner voice and a way of thinking about the problems that they maybe hadn't considered before. But when it comes time to what am I going to do about it, then you're the one who's letting them take the lead. The client does the work. That's the phrase that coaches like to use over and over.
So do you like get them to set goals for themselves kind of thing? And just sort of like just the fact that you're there and are going to be checking in with them like a month later to see the goals happen kind of thing is what helps? Or
yeah, it depends on exactly what we're trying to do. If we're working on a business idea, trying to take that passion and turn it into a business, then I've got a framework that I've worked out where it's first we work on the little inner voice. And in parallel, I teach them kind of basic project management so they can start moving forward on tasks. Because most people have maybe a 4 to 6 weeks worth of work that they can do before they run into an obstacle when they seek out a coach. So I teach them how to do that efficiently and how to set those goals, how to make sure they're managing their tasks. And then we check in on a weekly basis. And then at the same time, we're working on the mindset. We're working on the story that they're telling themselves and the kinds of things that they've been stuck on in the past. So we kind of run those two in parallel And then by the time that they've run out of things that they can do right now and they hit that obstacle, that thing that's holding them back right now, hopefully we've done enough work over here on the little inner voice side to give them the skills to overcome that. And if not, then that becomes the focus of what we do and really intensely work on what is holding you back. What's the story? How can we do that? And how can we change your beliefs to move you forward? And the thing that also has been kind of key is realizing the beliefs don't have to be rational. I think we all want things to make sense. We all want them to kind of be concrete, sequential. And especially if you're a high performer who does a lot of research, you want it to be provable, right? But many beliefs have no basis in reality whatsoever. They're not rational. And so getting people comfortable with forming a belief, even if it's not something anybody else would believe or find true, is a big breakthrough for people in that cycle of kind of getting things moving again.
Yeah. So how did you go from doing what you were doing in the business to just starting your own consultancy? Because that must have been quite a mindset shift to just do your own thing. Where did the confidence come to do that?
You know, it's been a gradual transition. And part of that is my own comfort level. I'm the sole provider for my family. My wife is a stay-at-home mom. So health insurance, the, you know, salary, it was all dependent on me. So I couldn't just stop one day and do something different. But it's also been the conflict that's driven me. I desperately want to have my own thing. I want to control my own destiny. Ever since I had that illness, it's been the one thing that I wanted more than anything else. So even when things were hard, even when I was bumping up against failure and finding I couldn't overcome something, I just kept beating my head against the wall, trying new things because I couldn't let it go. There was no part of me that was ever going to say, maybe I don't want to do this anymore. This I know is right for me and that can make a big difference in other people's lives. So I just kept pushing forward, started bringing on clients wherever I could at first. And I've done a better job since then because of that experience, kind of winnowing down the field of people who I'd work with, so that I can help them get good results and that they're not wasting their time and money and I'm not wasting my time and resources.
So these are people in your local area? Do you do this online?
It's online. So we do calls just like this where I can sit down with someone. We can go through for an hour kind of where things are at, where we're at in the sequence of events that we go through with the training. Usually I sit down for about 20 minutes and teach them something new to start, depending on where they're at. I've got kind of a 12-week calendar that I work through with folks. And then as their experiences diverge from what I'm teaching, we just go with it. Because obviously with one-on-one coaching, the idea is to get them the results that they're looking for.
Do you find that women have less confidence in starting a business first? Because of certainly, like, as someone who interviews a lot of entrepreneurs, like, I've had a bit of a gender imbalance on my podcast because there's just not so many women out there. And I'm trying to mainly prioritize just talking to women these days to sort of make it seem like better. But do you find that women have a confidence issue? Is it just that they're less interested in it at all? Or is that different in your clients in terms of what people have as their problems, I guess?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And what I found is the women I've worked with, it's not so much a confidence issue as it is a permission issue. They feel like the women I've worked with, they know what they want to do. They're smart women. They've had great careers up until this point, but they're waiting for someone to say, go do it. They're waiting for someone to say, this is okay, to be able to do something that they haven't done before that might be outside of kind of the realm of what they think is appropriate. So, you know, I've worked with one person who was a nutritionist, and she said that, you know, she had ideas, she had things, but she was constantly asking me, is that the right thing to do? Should I do this? Should I do that? And it was just a matter of her coming to the point where she said, this is okay. I don't need permission. This is not like a pass-fail situation. And once she was able to make that transition with her mindset, doors opened up and she just took off like rocket fuel. It was so cool to watch her have success from that point forward. But just getting there was a real struggle for her.
But certainly so interesting because I'm a big feminist and think that it'd be so much more useful to have women doing things which have been mostly male things like tech businesses and this kind of stuff because like the world needs like both viewpoints and stuff. So it's just super handy. But as a guy, it's kind of hard to sort of necessarily know exactly the right things to be coaching and saying and understanding. But I'm doing a mindset coaching session for like a women in business, big conference thing around the stuff, which is awesome. But I'm like, oh, I don't know exactly all of women's problems to me. So is there anything that I should have asked you that I haven't asked you?
Ooh. No, I think we've covered a lot of ground today. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about Little Inner Voice and kind of how people can turn that into a tool and to share my story.
Cool. Yeah, it's been really fun. And looking forward to catching up again and being interviewed on your side. It'll be fun. Then, Rati, one thing I haven't asked, I'd kind of like asking, is what do you see yourself in like 5 years' time? As in, where do you think you're going? Do you think you'll be like going on a completely different path again? Or is it growing? What are you aiming for?
In 5 years, I'd love to make Little Inner Voice something that is easily accessible and out there enough so that anybody who's thinking about stopping what they're doing today and doing something else, taking that passion, because I think so many people have this, right? Whether through a personal experience like me or something that you've kind of fallen into, like what you're doing here with Growth Mindset. I want to make sure that those people can easily find what we're doing and that we can help them do something cool. I obviously want to be successful in my own right, but I get the most pleasure and the most joy out of seeing people I've worked with have great success themselves. Mm. So I just want to be on a trajectory where we can do that a lot more than we do today.
Yeah, that's cool. And I know, I mean, I coached my friend's little sister in biology when I was at uni, and she was doing her A-levels, and she went to this college where like everyone, like they just didn't even take it seriously. Like, there was only like 4 kids in her class and they were all failing. And like most of the kids just took lots of drugs. And like, it was just like, it was a crap college where people just went to fail before like they actually sort of gave up on life and just got like a crap job. And like, I didn't even teach her that much biology. I just sort of like just taught her that she wasn't stupid and that she could get like whatever result she wanted. And she got like all A's, and then like she got like a funded scholarship and things. But she went from being like complete failure to that. I can't tell you how happy I was. I was like, so much better than when I got A's in my own type things. I was just like, wow, I just did that. But like, I didn't even put like any of the hard work. I just sort of did like sort of just a bit of like changing someone's mind.
And knowing that someone cares about you and your success, I mean, you've experienced it in your own life, and you've also helped other people experience it. That is such an amazing thing that somebody believes in you. That way you don't have to have the belief in yourself right now. Somebody else has it. And there's that sense that you don't want to let them down. So you try even harder and you both end up winning. It's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's great. Nice. And then the normal things that I ask at the end, what is your earliest memory that's quite distinct?
I have a really early memory. I was about 2 years old. I grew up, my first house was in Toledo, Ohio. My parents had this rickety old house and they were renovating the attic. And the attic was, the staircase to it was right outside my room. So I distinctly remember like poking my head up. So I must have climbed up those stairs, up into the attic, and seeing my mother and father on the other side of it working on the flooring there.
Mm. Yeah.
It doesn't mean anything to me. It's just it's that one early memory that I have.
Wow. Do you remember like what it smelled like and things? And
It's purely a visual. Like I literally just, it's the being able to see up over that threshold of the attic and seeing my mother and father probably 15 feet away on their hands and knees working on the flooring. That's it. That's all I've got.
Yeah. I mean, why does that stay in your memory? It doesn't seem like it's sort of tied to any like importance. And there must have been something that went into your brain and be like, oh my God, I've just done this, to like for it to then get remembered.
I don't know. I mean, if I had to guess now, like it would have been kind of an adventure, right? I mean, as a toddler going up a set of stairs unsupervised.
Yeah, yeah.
I imagine that was it, but I don't know why it would be.
Yeah, interesting. Cool. Okay. And then what's the kindest thing that someone's ever done for you?
The kindest thing someone's ever done for me. You know, I've led kind of a blessed life. I've had a lot of really nice people in my life, so it's hard to pick just one. I guess it would be the mentor I had in high school. She was such an amazing woman. She was the first person to really treat me like an adult. You know, 16, 17 years old, everybody kind of coddled me. And she was the first person who didn't. And it went both ways. It was, not only did she treat me with respect and expectations, it was, she didn't let me get away with stuff. You know, she'd call me out on my BS and really help shape me as a person as I went through those late teen years and into my career as a broadcaster. I think her taking me under her wing was an incredibly kind thing, something she certainly didn't have to do and yeah. didn't receive any benefit from doing, right? I was just another kid in school, one of thousands. So
it's amazing like what teachers can do sort of when they do go a bit outside of what they need.
And, you know, most of the time it costs you virtually nothing to do, yeah, right? Yeah. It's just a little bit of time out of your day and it could make a huge difference in someone else's. I love it. It's a great philosophy.
Yeah, cool. Oh, thanks very much for the whole conversation and this last bit as well. So, yeah, keep in touch, I guess.
Absolutely.
All right. Bye-bye.
Congratulations on listening to a whole episode of the Growth Mindset Podcast. Before you race into another podcast, try pausing. Ask yourself, what have you learned? What could you change? How will you make that change happen? Did you press pause? Knowledge is useless without action. What did you learn? What should you change? And how will you make that change happen? You can tell us what you learned by contacting us through the website, growthmindsetpodcast.com, and feel free to connect with us or our guests, or just peruse the show notes. Our Instagram is @growthmindsetpodcast, or follow me @samjamsnaps for a daily reminder to stop using Instagram. If you enjoy random acts of kindness and want to support the show, you can support us on Patreon or leave us a review on iTunes, and you'll make me very happy. And with that, keep learning and keep growing.